This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Well, as we're waiting for Stargazing Live to begin, I've managed to catch up with Dr. Matt Taylor, who's here and is going to be on the programme tonight. So, a warm welcome to the Jodcast.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Now, we were all very closely following the landing of Philae from the Rosetta mission onto the comet Churyumov.
Gerasimenko.
Thank you. Yeah.
67p, that'll be fine. Makes it easier.
So that must have been quite a nerve-wracking moment for you. We all know how dramatically it sort of bounced and everything, but it got down and it took data. So could you tell us a bit about what that was like, trying to follow that, and also what scientific results have come out so far?
Well, the mission itself lends itself to drama. I've only been on the mission for nearly 2 years now, so I've come in at the noisy period. We were very far away from the sun, so we had to go into hibernation a couple of years ago. We came back out of hibernation in January last year, so everything's happened in the last year. So we came out of hibernation, which was probably for me one of the most hectic periods, because we had no idea what the spacecraft was doing. We didn't know if it was still there. So it was really a binary switch from zero to one in terms of that. So that was a real relief. Then we had the rendezvous, which we'd never done before either. That was in August, so we got within 100 kilometres of the comet. And then the rest of the year was spent gradually edging towards the comet, getting a feel for what it's like to fly around the comet, because it's never been done before. In fact, I think about a year ago now, we still didn't know the shape of the comet. We didn't know that it looked like this funny black swan or duck. So that's something also to consider, that it's taken us... We had preconceptions, and now we've learned a lot more from the data so far.
Could you manoeuvre around it relatively freely?
In principle, yes, you can. I think one of the main things that we were doing last year, I think, again, this time last year, we were discussing how close we could get to it in terms of a bound orbit, actually classically bound by the gravity. It was thought maybe between 30 and 20 kilometres in a bounded kind of orbit, but eventually we actually got down to 10, so that was you modified your preconceptions of how you fly. But the problem you have with Rosetta is that it's a big spacecraft. It's about, well, it's got 64 square meters of solar panel, so you know, as you go out on a windy day, open your anorak up as you did when you were a kid, it's difficult to run into the wind, especially on the beach. You get loads of sand as well, which is a bit like the cometary environment. So we try and put the spacecraft in a situation where it's not projecting that much of a cross-section to the comet. So that's why we stay in these terminator orbits, so the solar panels, or the plane of them, is in the same plane as the terminator. So we spent a lot of time in that situation in around October last year. Then we kicked out, once we'd mapped the comet, again, this was the thing. A year ago, we didn't really know what the comet looked like. Then we had to rendezvous with it and put a lander on it. Mars missions, moon missions, they did a lot of orbits with different missions first, and then they put the lander down. We're doing those two phases in one, or we have done that now, I can say, in two phases of a mission evolution in one mission, as it were. It was mainly operational last year in terms of mapping the comet, but we were also doing science on the side. We learned a lot about the comet in terms of drawing a baseline, as it were, to the rest of the mission. Because the key thing is that the mission's rendezvoused, and it's going to stay alongside the comet for over a year, at least till the end of this year, and hopefully will extend. Key thing being, we go through perihelion in August this year, where it's most active. That will give us this range of relatively inactive comet that we were at last year to the maximum activity this year, and see how that changes. We'll see a change in the volume of the comet.
So you'll be expecting as the sun heats it up, it's going to be ejecting lots of material.
I mean, it's starting to do that now. Also, if you look at the images we're sending out from the navigation camera and OSIRIS camera, you're seeing this material come out, the dust and the gas that's flowing off the surface or out the subsurface. And we'll see changes in that. And that's the key thing. So we have a baseline formed from these first observations that it's very dark. It's got an albedo of something like 4 or 5%. So it's dark in the ash belt. That this is predominantly an organic material. That's what we believe it is. It's very dark organic material. There's little evidence of surface ice. Although now, perhaps this is driven by the activity, we're starting to see ice peeking through. So we're starting to see the inference that we're actually seeing surface ice, or maybe it's subsurface ice that's coming through. I guess this is the whole thing. If you're processing material and chucking it off, something's got to happen. You know, how are you redelivering, or where's this coming from? So where's this sublimating material, this gas coming from? So this is what we're seeing. We'll see that evolution. So we're starting to see the ice as well. We're starting to see the interaction of this gas coming off of the comet with the solar wind. that's starting to happen now as well. And possibly we might be seeing evidence maybe of a shock as well forming. So all this kind of stuff is starting to happen now, and then we'll see the evolution of how that changes. With Philae, we had about 60 hours of measurements. That was how it was planned to be. It was going to have a separation, descent and landing, a first sign sequence, and then a long-term science. Effectively, it's in between those two and three there. It was designed to go into hibernation. It wasn't designed to go into hibernation in a ditch, which it's in. So that's the thing. So we had to modify the first sign sequence to try and change a few things because of the location of it. We were actually a bit concerned to deploy the drill at first because it was worried that it might push it in a certain direction, topple it over. But we did all this stuff. Ultimately, it looks like the drill didn't actually touch the surface or get any stuff into the ovens, which we needed. And that's what we're hoping to do in the long-term science. So it's designed to go in hibernation. It's just a longer hibernation than we thought. Ultimately, if it had stayed where we'd aimed for, we'd be looking to the end of the mission now. So it was designed to go roughly till March, April time. And where we are now, we'd be in the midway of that long-term science and possibly looking at the end of the mission. This is driven by the temperature. So it has to cycle temperature. It's getting warmer on the surface. It has to cool down as well. So it has to have a good day and night cycle. Where we are, it's just not bright or warm enough yet. That will happen. We're starting to listen to it or listen for it now, because the lander's by itself, we can't really do anything to it. We're waiting for it to wake up, come out of hibernation. By May, I think, is when a number of us think that's when it'll happen, because
so you do think it's going to catch the sunlight again and recharge.
I'm an eternal optimist. I have to be to work on this mission. It's got the comet's got seasons, so the orbit raises above the ecliptic in the next few months. So the head part of the duck, where the lander we think it is starting to become more illuminated. So that'll bring the temperature up and give you that better profile in terms of charging. So that's May seems to be a good point to maybe put a couple of quid each way on it.
And I guess the whole purpose of the mission is looking at the comet as a almost like a fossil of our solar system. So, as you mentioned, ice, what other kind of things could we expect to find?
Well, it's these building blocks. I think this is the thing. This keeps on being brought up, and as you're alluding to, it's this, I'll use the classic, the treasure chest from the primordial mix that we had at the beginning of the solar system. Some of the preliminary observations we've seen in terms of looking at deuterium to hydrogen ratios in the water that's coming off gives you an indication of where the comet formed. There are other things that we'll be measuring, noble gases, etc., and other ratios of different volatiles that give us more of a fix on where the comet formed with respect to the protoplanetary disk, so whether it was close or far away from the sun. These deuterium to hydrogen ratios show that it was very far away, that it's a classic Kuiper Belt object, I've been reliably informed. So it's been outside on the edge for quite a long time, maybe from the beginning. Maybe some of the stuff on it predates the solar system. But the key thing there, knowing that it's a very old object, then puts into context everything else. So all the other observations we'll make when we go through perihelion, it becomes more active. That's when you'll say, well, because of this, this, and this, it gives you the better fix on where this thing came from, and therefore what the ultimate mix of material was at the beginning of the solar system.
How do they know what the other Kuiper Belt objects are like?
Well, the measurement of this deuterium to hydrogen is actually made by the orbiter. But yeah, this is a good question. Now, our preconceptions of these Jupiter-class comets, so we visited mainly Oort cloud comets before. This one is the first time I think we've actually visited locally. We've had observations from Herschel of other Jupiter-class comets, which actually had a deuterium to hydrogen ratio that was more similar to the Earth. So there was this big question about our comets a viable, efficient delivery mechanism of water to the Earth, because it's the other thing, looking at the dry Earth scenario, the wet Earth scenario in the early solar system when we had the heavy bombardment. Prior to that, the Earth, one of the theories is that all the water boiled off. Something had to deliver that back.
So these comets came from Kuiper Belt.
So this was one theory before Rosetta, actually. It was thought that, okay, asteroids have been shown to be a delivery mechanism, but also we were showing with a couple of these comets observed with Herschel that there was a deuterium to hydrogen ratio very similar to that of Earth. So again, it's, look, these are these primordial small bodies that seem to have delivered stuff to the Earth. With the comets, you also link the fact that they've got organics on them as well. So maybe you can say, draw the line, they've delivered water, we found pre-sort of DNA protein-like molecules in other comets. So you make that link as well, that you're providing or delivering, as well as water, the other vital ingredients to start life off. Not life itself, but the building blocks. So that's that complication, as you have with science, that now we've shown this one is a really, really high D2H ratio. So we actually have this span of values of D2H with the Kuiper Belt objects, which just says we need to rethink how these bodies evolve and where the water comes from. It's not to say that Jupiter-class comets didn't deliver anything to the Earth. It's more their evolution through time over the solar system lifetime may have been more complicated than we first thought, or at least maybe these ones that Herschel looked at. But it's clear that asteroids are still in that part where they would have delivered the water as well. But it's not to rule out
comets. But comets aren't all the same. So
no, this is true. We're seeing that they're not the same. There's quite a few of them as well. We've only visited or observed a few of them. I mean, for me, that's something else that we'll get with Rosetta. We have this close-up view for over a year. Gives you that context for all of the other measurements that have been made before, because we're doing ground-based, although it's a bit ropey at the moment because it's in solar conjunction and you can't see it very well. But after summer this year, it'll come back into full view. So you're making remote sensing as well as being in situ there. So those, you can make that cross comparison to maybe only every other, but most of the other cometary observations we make from the ground or near Earth. So I think that's nice as well, that you've got that very detailed look at one comet. You have the contextual ground-based observations to fit in with your conceptions and theories of all the other comets. So that's an added extra.
Could there be a sort of life cycle on the comets where they change over time? Or will all of these things have come from different places?
Well, this is it. I mean, even this comet itself, it's thought that I think in 1959 it was originally a bit further out. Its perihelion is about 1.2 AEU, but it was out at 2.7, I think, before that. And I think that Jupiter perturbed it. But then once you start backtracking further than that, it gets a bit scratchy as to what was happening with it. I think they say normally they've got about 50 or 100 orbits of them, and then they start to run out. This one's been around a few times. It's not a very active comet. When you compare it to Ison and some of these other Oort cloud comets, these are the sun grazers, they come in and they really are, you know, bright and breezy, coming very quickly, lots of stuff coming off of them. But Kuiper Belt are less, or certainly these shorter period comets are less active because they might be in there a bit more. But in terms of processing, this is a nice comet to choose because it had this perihelion kick, so it only came in closer or recently. So maybe it's not as processed.
Looking beyond this particular mission, what would be next?
That's a good question. That then taps into how ESA does its science. So we make calls to the community to get them to propose missions, and that's where one would see something like this come in. Unfortunately, I would say at the moment there's no scope for something as big as Rosetta, and in fact I would also say that if Rosetta was proposed now, ESA probably wouldn't accept it because it's too risky. But there was a point in time, way, you know, 20 odd years ago, where people were a bit more risk, but they wanted to do this. There is an aversion to risk for very good reasons. We're trying to spread things out a little bit more, but that would be where we're looking. There are some talks of going to the asteroid belt. Now, there's an easy way of describing these small bodies and saying you've got the Kuiper Belt, the Oort cloud, and the asteroids. But it looks like there's a mix of the whole Kuiper Belt thing, the fact that they look like they've had different evolutionary strains, and very recently they've shown asteroids that have cometary-like behaviour as well. So it looks like they weren't different animals in a zoo. Maybe they're the same strain of animals. You know, you've got big cats and, I don't know, domestic cats somewhere. I don't know, something like that. It's as usual, not as easy to subdivide all these things.